I do that, let me say thank you to Michael and Katia in particular, who really put their backs into putting this together. And it's, you can tell it's worked, and it's a real it's a real delight to see the Ericsson IP network blossoming. The Ericsson IPE network, we're united by IPE, but divided on how you write the letter ER. Obviously, that's going to be one of the major issues you might want to discuss in the last session. Anyhow, let me say a few words about our key speaker. There are three reasons, I think, why I'm really happy to introduce Matt Watson to you. The first is a selfish reason, insofar as he and I once were colleagues at the University of Warwick, and it's always nice to hook up with Matt and to have a chance to listen to him, because he is one of the most interesting speakers I know. The second reason, I think, why Matt is a particularly appropriate speaker for this event is that he's a champion of graduate students and newer members of the profession. If you've worked with Matt and seen what he does up close, you'll know that he looks after mentors and does a lot of work to sort of bring young IP scholars on, and yeah, it's nice there are so many people who fall into that category here today, and I think Matt's a very appropriate person to have for that reason. And the third reason, I think, is to do with Matt's work. I mean, we can say of a few people that their work makes us think. That's a rare privilege to be given that. I think with Matt, you can also say that he often changes the way you think. I mean, I have empirical evidence for this. Every year I teach an IPE class, and every year I have students who come up to me having read Matt's work, which I assign relentlessly to them, as some of them will know, and they say to me, look, I didn't realise that about Adam Smith. That's completely transformed the way that we were taught about economics, for example. So Matt is one of these people who can kind of cut through what you've been taught and make you think again. He's Professor of International Political Economy at the University of Warwick, and he is the author of books that you will know quite well, particularly Foundations of International Political Economy, which is one of those books that if you're coming into IPE for the first time is something that you should definitely read. He's also written a book called The Political Economy of International Capital Mobility, a book that's just about to come out, that's finished and is in press. It's called Uneconomic Economics and the Crisis of the Modern World, which will be out early 2014. He's also told me about the two further books that he's currently working on, one which should be out in 2015 called IPE and the History of Economics Imperialism. That should be fun. And a little further ahead, the book after that is called Robinson Crusoe and the Foundations of Economics. Now, why is Matt writing these books? The answer is that he has recently been awarded by the UK Economic and Social Research Council a professorial fellowship. And it's worth saying that a professorial fellowship from the ESRC is not something that's given randomly. They're given to scholars who've already achieved a level of distinction in their field with the expectation that they are going to make major contributions to their disciplines and to society. In a wider sense. His fellowship is organised around the concept of rethinking the market. And I'm going to shut up now and let Matt speak on his topic today, the social specificity of the market concept, the place of IPE in the history of economic thought. He's going to speak for about 40 minutes. We will have time for Q&A, and hopefully you won't cut too much into the coffee break, because I know there are Danes here, and that's really important. Matt, it's all yours.
Well, thank you very much, Ben, and thanks for such a generous introduction. Not quite sure what I've done to deserve it. I do know, though, that I'm quite pleased that after listening to that, my parents aren't in the room. I think my mum would have been on the front row weeping, saying, that's my son, that's my son. And my dad would probably have been looking around for this other Matthew Watson. So I'm delighted. That they're not present in the room as well. It's a real honour to be here. This is your first workshop, of course, and to be the first speaker at the first workshop is an honour that, by definition, only goes to one person. So I really hope that I'm going to be able to come up with the goods this morning and not to let you down after such an invite. One of the things that I am required to do in my role as an ESRC professorial fellow is to try to generate new capacity within my specialist research field, and also to seek international collaborations for UK social science. Thank you on behalf of my funders as well for inviting me here, because it allows me to tick those two boxes at the same time. I think it's a wonderful initiative that you're starting, and please just do keep in touch with me if there's anything that I can do in future years, if there's anything I can do in future years to bring more of my Warwick connections into your network, then I'm more than happy to do that. This is exactly the sort of thing that the IPE community globally needs to be happening at the moment. We are, of course, in an IPE moment. If we don't have interesting things to say about the nature of the world as it's unfolding in rather rickety fashion around us, then who can do? And if we're not the sort of people that might also be able to think that the world could be different to how it's structured today, then I think IPE is letting not only us, but also the rest of the world down. So good on you, and let's see how far we get today. Now, I introduced myself a few minutes ago as an accidental IPE scholar, and I think in many ways that I am. I wasn't trained in IPE. IPE was something early in my career that I was given to teach. And because I was given to teach it, I was required to at least be about half an hour in front of my students on a weekly basis for that first year. So it required me to go and learn what IPE was. And it was an interesting experience learning what IPE was from the perspective of already thinking that I knew myself as a scholar, thinking that I already knew that where I wanted to specialise was in questions of the history of economic thought. So I've always been able to bring that lens to my IPE studies, and it maybe allows me to always be there somehow as the outsider, with one foot definitely in the IPE camp, but always allowed to say rather different things. And it's some of those different things that I want to talk about this morning, in particular looking at the market concept and how that's evolved in the history of economic thought. Now, for a talk of this nature, I'm going to start in an unusual place. And if I look a little bit shifty when I'm playing around with the PowerPoint, that's because I don't usually use it, and I'm neither very familiar nor very proficient with PowerPoint. So it could go all over the place. So here's my first PowerPoint slide for this talk in IPE. There we are. Now, why do I want to start here? Well, for me, this is an image that suggests the importance of the literature in social psychology. Well, obviously, look at it. And in particular, I want to start with the literature on the social psychology of fear, because there are two ways in which a community tries to respond to its fears. Firstly, it creates social structures to exclude those fears. So this is an externalization process. The ability to try to control the fears by turning that thing of which the community is afraid into something so radically alien that it no longer has to be taken seriously. The second way, however, that a community tries to control its fears is by internalizing those fears, by taking steps to try to render that of which it's afraid more and more familiar. So this is about embracing features of the other rather than creating radical otherness out of that thing which causes us to be afraid. And I'm interested in this notion of fear because it's long been my concern that IPE as a whole suffers from something that I would want to call econophobia, the fear of economics. And I think it's probably evident within the way in which IPE debates are structured that both of these social psychological responses to fear are apparent. I've spent pretty much the whole of my career worrying about this tendency to econophobia, and also worrying about what that does to limit the way that we in IPE can think about the nature of the world around us. Let me just give you a couple of very quick examples about the way that I see this fear of economics taking hold. And if you'll permit me, I'll just use, for the reasons of explication, Jerry Cohen's recent distinction between the British and the American school of IPE. Lots of things wrong with those labels, lots of things wrong with that whole way of thinking, but it's a useful heuristic to try to just give you a sense of what I'm talking about here. Because I think from those two separate transatlantic poles, we find very different ways of the IPE community trying to resolve its fears, its latent fears of economics. From Cohen's British school, for instance, a group of scholars who show some sort of distaste for economics in all of its forms, almost a pathological distaste. And this leads to a broad brush rejection that anything that economists say must be wrong because it's being said by economists. There is this instinct for externalization within the British school of IPE when it comes to anything that arises from economics. And whenever possible, ridicule might be used as some sort of rhetorical strategy for trying to keep these fears under wraps. If we can make economics and therefore economists look a little bit silly in the things that they say about the world, then that means that we don't have to take their work seriously. And I think, and I'll tell you in a minute why, that that's something of a shame. But Cohen's American School seems to have taken a completely different route out of its own econophobia. What we see there is open embrace through emulation, economics particularly as method. So the method of economics is used specifically as a way of generating models, that have explanatory content, but also limit the things that you can explain about the nature of the world. When we hear American school IPE scholars talk about their peak publishing strategies and the sorts of journals that this relates to, it's those journals that allow them to show their skills at having emulated economics method as a way of trying to explain the world. So this is a route out of econophobia which requires those American school IPE scholars to embrace economics, to embrace its methodological insights, and to try to render themselves familiar to it by beginning to imitate economics. I come with a slightly different story to tell this morning, though. It's clear to me that IPE's transatlantic schools have come up with their own ways of negotiating their economophobia, but I'm also pretty convinced in my own mind that neither of these are the most useful responses. There's much to be made, I would want to argue, from continued engagement with economics, but from a history of economic thought perspective. Maybe specifically from a history of economic thought perspective. For a start, both of Cohen's schools managed to universalize what can be understood by the label economics. Economics becomes one thing rather than the plurality of different ways of viewing the world. And I think we see that plurality very, very clearly when we begin to think of economics from a history of economic thought perspective. So let's have a look what the two schools suggest about economics in general. Well, firstly, the British school. I think the British school falsely homogenises the whole of economics around its neoclassical core. Now, it's not wrong to want to be critical of the vision of economic life that emerges from that core. I guess a lot of my work tries to do the same thing. But you don't have to stand decisively outside of economics, and you certainly don't have to have a dismissive attitude of economics as a whole to be able to ground that critique. You can use the work of other economists very effectively to try to critique the developed neoclassical core of economics. And greater attention to the history of ideas might allow the IPE scholar to do two things. Firstly, to isolate those moments that the core of economics took on its distinctively neoclassical feel in the first place, and secondly, as a means of understanding more about possible alternatives. For me, the history of economic thought literature is absolutely cram-packed full with potential alternatives. Alternatives in terms of forms of analysis, alternatives also in terms of forms of economic life that we might be able to imagine and that we might be able to struggle politically towards. What about the American school? Well, I think this also falsely homogenises the whole of economics around its neoclassical core, but it does so for very different reasons. Neoclassical economics provides a particular type of explanatory model that's used extensively by American school scholars. It becomes a study of logic, a study in the logic of what can be expected to happen if economic agents take a particular form. If they take that form where they're stripped of all the other potential socializing elements that might help to make up their life and their experience of what it means to be them, other than their own innate rationality. And I think that a greater attention to the history of economic thought can once again allow the IPE scholar to do two things in this respect. First, it can allow us to work with the critical methodological literature in economics itself which concerns the limits of this way of thinking and which seeks to challenge this way of thinking. And I also believe that this becomes a means, secondly, to understand more about possible alternatives. And those alternatives should be understood politically as much as they should be understood intellectually as well. For me, what's always attracted me to the history of economic thought is that it provides opportunities to distance oneself from the core of economics without needing to distance oneself from economics as a whole. And it provides these opportunities somewhat curiously, I think, because of the way that neoclassical economists themselves understand the history of their own subject field. Actually, there are two ways. There are two distinct strategies that we see within this literature. The first one is to insist that the history of economic thought does not matter because all that counts is what economists believe to be true today. Perhaps the best quote along these lines comes from the Nobel laureate and Chicago economist George Stigler. In dismissing the whole history of his subject field before he came to write in it anyway, he said that the history of economics should be thought of like the history of weather forecasting, that the economics of 200 years ago is about as useful to us today as the weather forecast from 200 years ago. And if you really, really, truly believe that, then only current forms of economic analysis can be valid, and everything else that comes before must necessarily simply be dismissed. There's also another way that neoclassical economists tell the history of their own subject field, and that's more obviously seen through the work of another Nobel laureate, but not a Chicago economist this time, an MIT economist, Paul Samuelson. Now, Samuelson's view is that the history of economic thought matters, but only matters in a small way. It matters only to the extent that it allows us to identify clear preemptions of what is known to be true today. Now, Samuelson's wonderful quote along these lines is to try to stand up for the classical political economists, but doing so in a slightly backhanded way. How's this for a real endorsement of what they do? He said, and I quote, that within every classical writer, there was a neoclassical economist waiting to be born. So in other words, you can project yourself backwards and reread classic texts in the history of thought simply to find those moments in which they confirm what you believe is true today. This goes against pretty much every Skinnerian methodological rule in the history of ideas, but this is what neoclassical economists really believe. And just pause for a moment to think of the Straussian implications of that dualism when Samuelson talks on the one hand about classical writers and on the other hand about neoclassical economists. You only deserve the label economist once you've shed yourself of all the assemblage of classical political economy and once you've become a true neoclassical theorist. So we have another notion of history. It's not as dismissive as the Stigler notion of history, but at the same time, it's there to suggest that the history doesn't really matter. What we have there is an overly linear conception of intellectual history, but one that does reflect to a degree the tendency for economics to revolve through a series of distinct turning points. And I think those turning points themselves are particularly important, and they're important for a number of reasons. Firstly, from Stigler's perspective, because they bury the past. Simply, if former types of economic analysis are simply not useful, then the turning points become the means through which you can bury the past successfully. From Samuelson's point of view, it's slightly more subtle because they allow the past to be superseded by something better. Most neoclassical economists follow Samuelson in believing that what they're trying to do is a truly scientific mode of analysis. And to become increasingly scientific means that you have to move from a past in which you're less scientific through a series of iterative stages where you become more scientific to the point at which you can arrive, with Samuelson holding your hand no doubt, at genuine science. But for me, these turning points are important for a completely different reason. They're important because they allow the intellectual controversies of the time to be brought back to life. They allow us to understand that there were multiple roads that economics could have travelled down at particular moments of time, but didn't. If the history of economics is all about the alignment and realignment of a core that we now see manifested within neoclassical economics, how did that core come into being in the first place? And what were the historical alternatives that were suppressed along the way? This, for me, is the great beauty of the history of economic thought. It connects us back to those suppressed historical alternatives. It gets us to ask the questions about the social conditions under which a particular type of economic analysis came to dominate. And I think we can situate those questions in as genuinely political frame of reference as we can do to understand the history of economic thought, not just as some simple linear conflagration that allows us suddenly to become scientific in this moment of great epiphany, but something that is continually struggled over, where there is contestation around even the most simple forms of economic meaning at various different points of this intellectual history. So that history can come back to life, but only if we take it seriously enough to want to do that. Let me give you an example of these three different ways of reading the history of economic thought. If we look very briefly at the marginalist revolution of the 1870s, the first inkling of what economics has latterly become in its neoclassical guise. For Stigler, the marginalist revolution is just a flash of genius, that consigns bad economics to the dustbin. Nothing else needs to be said. The world has moved on, and we don't care what it looked like before this turning point. For Samuelson, it's simply another in the series of the moves in the right direction to an increasingly scientific form of economic analysis. It's about enhancing scientific credentials. There's some wonderful mathematical sleight of hand in Samuelson's work, where he reads back into classical economic texts his own preference for trying to understand the whole of the world through a series of simultaneous equations. And so what he decides is wrong with classical political economy in its totality is that once you impose this mathematics on it, you find out, guess what, that there are more unknowns in the theoretical system than there are equations to describe those unknowns. And of course, history, intellectual history, evolving onwards, is ever more to try to align the number of unknowns in the theoretical system with the number of equations that you can use to describe those unknowns. Hooray for intellectual history then. But for me, the significance of the marginalist revolution is its political significance and how economics came to be part of the political solutions that were found at that time to trying to make sure that the coming of mass democracy did not do too much to disrupt the settled social order. This was a huge question in operation at the time. You increasingly have more and more people, by people I guess I mean men at that stage, you have more and more men able to vote. If they are able to vote, might they vote for things that will favour them? How do you manage to maintain respect and deference to an established social order built on hierarchy if you have an economic theory that can be moulded to the coming of mass democracy to create trouble for the established order? So neoclassical economics, in its way of bypassing through the marginalist revolution potentially the radical implications of Ricardian socialism, is one way of creating some sort of safety blanket for the existing social order. So this, for me, is one of the ways that we can see the significance of the history of economic thought, and hopefully we can bring that significance to bear in the sorts of discussions we have in IPE today, which is what I think I've said just there. Now, if I turn to the specific content of what I'm meant to be talking about today, I think that the marginalist revolution has had arguably its most profound effect in changing the language that we use to describe everyday economic life. And there's little focus on this in IPE, not as much focus as I think there should be. I think we should study more the sorts of language that we use to describe everyday economic life. Those forms of expression that we have which allow us to capture our everyday hopes, our everyday fears, and how they're projected to a particular type of economic system that at one level we're all incorporated into, but another level often seems as though it stands beyond us and it's very difficult for us to shape individually. I think we should be looking more and more at these sorts of issues. The way that we narrate these potential futures that we could live, the way that we narrate our own idea of our economic subjectivity, is still, I would argue, almost wholly captive to the changes in economic language unleashed by the marginalist revolution. I think the most important thing about marginalism within economics is that it's set in train a particular conception of the market that it's become so hard to escape today. It becomes so much part of the language that we use to describe our everyday lives that it becomes increasingly difficult for us to think of those lives being situated somehow outside of that narrative frame of marketness. If we can only talk about alternative economic futures in terms of more market or less, then it immediately constrains what can be envisioned as a viable political proposition of how we might be able to live our lives individually, and also how we as a community might be able to live our shared social life. There might be nothing beyond that instinctive market frame if no language other than the language of the market becomes imaginable as a relevant and a valid language of the economy. On a little bit of a tangent, perhaps this is one of the reasons why the global financial crisis has largely been a missed opportunity for progressive social forces. It might help to explain why things look remarkably the same, even as we pass through such a generic upheaval in the way that economic life has lived. What's resulted after all of this political head-scratching about the nature of the market world is in general a simple reassertion of the need to create, recreate, and protect those institutional structures which allow the market world to be experienced as it is. For me, this might be down to the fact that we lack a language beyond the language of markets in which to adequately explain those alternative visions of the future that we might have. There could be a structure of plausibility, to coin a rather inelegant phrase, that impacts upon us in a way that we're maybe not all that aware of, certainly that I'm not aware of in the way that I live my life, but that becomes necessarily skewed in favour of the status quo. Is it inherently more believable to be asked to support policies which differ from one another only in their different gradations of marketness than it is inherently believable to be asked to support policies which exist in a language frame which is completely liberated from the notion of markets and the market world? I really don't know the answer to that question, but I just throw it out there as something that at least can be asked if we become attentive to the history of economic thought within IPE and the way that in the history of economic thought, particular economic concepts such as that of the market have had a particular political meaning ascribed to them. One thing that I suspect it would be useful for us to know more about in IPE than we currently do is the changing form of the market concept in the history of economic ideas. This is a concept that's been there since the birth of modern economics. If Ben has been running a small book betting on the first moment that I would mention Adam Smith, he's done this to me before when I've given presentations, then I think the answer is 9 minutes past 10. So if anyone's sitting with 9 minutes past 10 in this particular sweepstake, you're the winner, because I'm going to mention Adam Smith briefly now. Pardon?
Nobody was that late.
Nobody was that late. That means I've got to speed up, doesn't it? Okay, I get the subliminal messaging. So the notion of the market has been there in economics right from its earliest moments. But in The Wealth of Nations, Smith talked about the marketplace and not the market. He talked about the marketplace in a particular way. The marketplace was always surrounded by some sort of signifier of motion. Goods were being brought to the marketplace. People were going to the marketplace. It signified this physical meeting place in which commercial activity could take place. No behavioural logic was inferred from the concept itself. The market didn't mean anything in terms of prescribing particular forms of behaviour. It simply meant a meeting place, a set of physical coordinates where the community would agree to meet one another and go about their daily commercial activities. When it comes to behavioural logic, Smith certainly didn't sidestep the issue, indeed the theory of moral sentiments. For all of Ben's master's students who are now made to read bits of the theory of moral sentiments and blame me for it, sorry, but it's great anyway. Indeed, the theory of moral sentiments can be read as an extended treatise of what sort of person would be most appropriate to protect the institutional arrangements of the late 18th century marketplace. He asked the question repeatedly, what happens when you have to look into somebody's face in order to try to arrange the way that you're going to trade with them? And the answer that he came to was that you needed a structure of propriety to make sure that everyone kept within reasonable bounds in the relationships that they had with one another. But propriety, he thought, differed. It differed historically, it differed over time, but it also differed culturally. So if market arrangements required some degree of personal propriety so that the individual market agents could make those institutional arrangements work, then there was no suggestion that that structure of propriety would be the same in all places. There was, as I've got in the title of my talk today, social specificity in the market concept right from its very earliest times. And this is one of the things that has gone missing, and I think a history of economic thought perspective can identify both when it went missing and, more importantly, why it went missing. Whether there are particular political reasons for that social specificity going missing in the first place. Now, fast forward a bit. Not much changed from Smith's original articulation of the idea of the marketplace over the next 100 years of economic thought. Economic theory changed significantly. Smithian moral economy was very quickly superseded by Ricardian abstractionism. Ricardian abstractionism went in many different directions. It was systematized through Millian liberalism on one hand. It went in the radical Marxist direction in the other hand. But throughout that next 100 years, the concept of the market as some sort of physical meeting place for day-to-day commercial activity stayed pretty much exactly as it was. The change only occurred during the Marginist Revolution, which is why I've handily been using that as my example for the broader approach. Here we see a shift from an objective to a subjective theory of value. Very briefly, because I'm struggling for time, I know. Objective theories of value have become inherently radicalised during the late 19th century, suggesting the possibility of controlling commercial activities taking place in marketplaces in the interest of greater social equality. The move to a subjective theory of value first began to turn the concept of market, however, from a purely descriptive into a normative concept. So behavioural logics first began to be implied by using the word market only with the Marginist Revolution. What we see there is a gentle urging of an individual newly identified as consumer to go to the market to realise a future of contentedness through acts of consumption. This is a really, really important shift and something that's not commented upon half as much as it should be, even in specialist history of economic thought literature. Other economists had spoken about consumption practices before the Marginist Revolution, but it's only with the move towards neoclassical economics that the consumer appears as some sort of behavioural ideal type around which a whole theoretical system can then be organised. The next great change takes place in the 1930s, I would argue, with the introduction of the Robbins definition of economics. The Robbins definition of economics focuses primarily on choice under conditions of scarcity. So if you assume the notion, the existential notion of scarcity, you then ask how to make the most effective, the most efficient choices under those conditions, and you get a brand new concept of market coming to the fore. So the Robbins definition chose this notion of choice under conditions of scarcity. What he wanted to do was to isolate those acts that were definitively economic and to restrict economics accordingly to talking only about those acts. And he used a rather generic English language meaning of economise to do that. Choice under conditions of scarcity means economizing. Economizing in relation to some sort of implicit maximization principle. What Polanyi only 10 years later ridiculed as the economistic fallacy. To believe, to falsely believe, that all acts of in relation to the economy can be captured by this single behavioural instinct to economise. It's much more complicated, said Polanyi, and he was exceptionally right when he said that. Look what happens to the concept of market here. The Robbins definition presupposes the prior existence of market institutions. To have choice under scarcity, you have to have something that makes sense of scarcity in the first place. The only reason that you have scarcity is that you have market institutions. The institutions themselves create the scarcity in which you're asked to choose between one option and another. So to have the Robbins definition of economics, you must already be assuming the presence of market institutions. And this view of economics limits the whole subject field accordingly to discussing only those aspects of everyday life that take place within markets. This remains market conceived in its normative sense. To truly economise in behaviour requires that the economy is always set up to replicate the image of the market world, but another shift has taken place here, and it's a very, very, very important political shift. It's from a normative conception of market that gently urges the consumer to make their own life within market institutions, to a normative conception of market that authorises market institutions to make those choices for us. If we're all at hoc to these maximisation principles and the behavioural logic that defines our economic activities is simply to be the maximiser within these market institutions, then what choice are we actually making? Robbins's choice under scarcity is a very curious notion of choice. It's the market institutions that are telling us where this maximisation principle can be found, and how we should align our behaviour with that maximisation principle. And under Robbins's definition of economics, it's therefore market institutions making choices for us. If the economic problem is to make the most effective decision in the context of scarcity, then we're pretty much giving our economic subjectivity up to those market institutions to play a determining role for us. What we have here, as I've got on the PowerPoint, is an increasingly disciplinary usage of the notion of market. If markets are, by definition, able to guide us to the best possible outcome, where we maximise whatever it is that we're trying to maximise, then they have to be left alone to self-regulate. Doing this allows them to impose their own solution onto us. But at the same time, it's also to ascribe to market institutions an essential agential capacity. It's for us to give up our agential capacity by assuming that markets themselves have this ability to impose themselves as agents upon the choices that we make. This shift in the way that the notion of market is used is to give to markets their own interests and to give to them a will to act upon those interests. This is politically very, very disabling. And yet, if this is the only language of the economy that we have in modern circumstances to talk about everyday economic life, we seem to be caught in a trap that's created by the language itself. Okay, last slide, Ben. Last couple of minutes, if that's okay. What has any of this to do with IPE is the title of my last slide. I think it maybe has four things to do with IPE. Firstly, we use the language of markets in IPE as much as, perhaps even more so, than any other social scientific subject field. And yet we don't always stop to question what we mean when we use that language of markets. And I think by applying this history of economic thought perspective, it shows that there's plenty of scope for the IPE community to become much more attentive to the way in which significant turning points in the history of economic ideas have changed what this most fundamental of economic concepts actually means. No meaning ever comes from nowhere. No meaning ever comes from nowhere, either socially or historically. And I think it's important to try to recover those moments in which meaning was imposed upon a particular concept in a particular way, and also to ask about the reasons for why that might have happened. Secondly, I think it suggests that if we choose to be really brave, we in IPE might even find a way of occupying some intellectual space that's been progressively vacated by economics. Now, most economists really do genuinely believe that their models tell them useful things about the world. And in thinking that, they vacate this territory where once upon a time there would have been more inductively oriented forms of economic knowledge being generated through close empirical studies of social structures and the way that those social structures help to underpin the economy. This, once upon a time, was economics. I'm really not sure it's economics anymore, and I think we can understand how economics vacated the territory and we can move in to be able to replace what was once there within economics, but which is no longer there. Thirdly, I also think that these issues remind us to focus on the social specificity of the market concept. It is a concept that's become inherently universalised. It's seen to have this one meaning for everyone, wherever in the world they are, whatever it is that they're trying to do within their economic lives. But it's universalism that dogs so much of social science. And an alternative focus on social specificity, I think in any case, is much to be admired. It's the recognition that the experience of market institutions can differ from country to country, from community to community, from social group to social group, from person to person, and even for a single person at two distinct moments of time. Even if those two distinct moments of time are no more than that apart, the whole meaning of the concept of market can differ for them in the way that they try to shape their world. And fourthly, this is what attracted me to IPE in the first place. When I was made to teach IPE courses, I didn't do them and run to the hills as quickly as I could in search of other courses that were more attractive to me. I kept teaching IPE all of the way through my career because it has allowed me to engage politically, not only with my students, but also with myself and the way that I think about life. I really do believe that by looking more closely at the language that we use to describe our economic experiences, in particular the language we use to describe that concept of the market, that it allows us to think more thoroughly that the world might always be different. And I think there's no greater justification for practicing IPE than that, and hopefully it's the sort of thing that you in your new network will be able to talk about for years to come. Thank you very much.